Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome, welcome, one and all, to the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home, presumably, unless you're listening on an iSmart Android device via some app by TuneIn or Stitcher or WhoTunes, or possibly any one of a number of others. You would know that because you've already been to HeadOnRadioNetwork.com to go to the chat room. Well, maybe, no, you're not. Don't get ahead of yourself, Bob, to go to use the Listen Live button, which is the handiest, dandiest way of all, if you're working with a PC, to listen to this program. It is the 11th day of September 2014. I am broadcasting live from under the desk, where I am living in fear of another terrorist attack. I do that every year, about this time. No, I don't. But apparently much of America does. Certainly official Washington does. Yes, this is that anniversary again. But we'll try to do a regular program, because this year it just so happens that September 11th falls on Thorn in the Side Thursday. And we all know what Thorn in the Side Thursday is about on the Horn, right? Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Thorn in the Side Thursday is that day which is set aside to take note of those right-wing moments that make us go, "Oh!" Yeah, and we have an absolute abundance of them this evening. Of course, you may bring any other particular thorns that you may find on your little rose bush of life as you deem most appropriate and most fit. Yes, indeed. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. It is September the 11th, 2014, the 13th anniversary of our national undoing. And what a way to celebrate it, by opening a brand new war. Well, is it a new war, or is it the old war with a new coat of paint? You know, bloody paint on it. I'm not sure. You know, President Not Sure went to the nation last night to propose a new war that's definitely not the same as the old war. He's quite certain of it, against ISIL. And he's absolutely sure that we will not be using boots on the ground, so we won't be squandering 5,000 or more or less lives. Not to mention all the walking wounded who came home from Dim Leader's adventure in the sand. But we're getting our war on. And I mentioned this briefly last night. Just as we begin this Thorn in the Side Thursday, because it is kind of a thorn, Can we have a discussion, if you're interested, of course. We can talk about other things as well. I mean, we've got some sublimely gratuitous topicality out there that we can examine this evening as well. But can we talk about warfare and the United States? And particularly the legal structure, procedure that is set up whereby the United States goeth, yea, verily, unto war? If you were listening to Dr. Bill this week, you would have heard him. You would have heard him mention a quote from James Madison. And of course, when you listen to Dr. Bill, you're actually getting some of the most pure, unvarnished, no kidding, primary source derived history that you could well imagine. I mean, we're talking about master's and PhD level teaching for free, absolutely for free. And the people who are devotees of Dr. Bill, and there are many of them, well, they'll tell you that there's nothing quite like it. You know, nobody's going to stop it. Dr. Bill's never going to stop in the middle of his program to hawk a book or a vitamin supplement, like, you know, an herbal hair regrowth formula or a bowling ball that's been bounced on a Swedish mattress and picked up by an Oric vacuum cleaner or a Bose Wave radio hawking ads for buy gold now. There's never been a better time to buy. Dr. Bill is not going to do that. This is the straight stuff, no chaser. And you might notice, or you might have noticed, that he spoke some this week about a quote that was actually sent to him by our buddy Mike. About warfare. By James Madison. No nation, Madison wrote, no nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. Well, guess where we are? Continual warfare, and have been since 13 years ago. And before that, of course, there was Bush War I, also trumped up on false pretenses. And then there was Grenada and Panama. Yeah. And, of course, Vietnam and Korea. Particularly since the close of the Second World War, we have been in a state of continual, persistent warfare. And oddly enough, we've sacrificed a lot of our freedom, there's that word, in so engaging in it. Yeah. Well, here we go again. You know, what is it? Afghanistan has been referred to over the centuries as the graveyard of empire. The British took a righteous ass kicking there. The Russians took one. Now we've taken one. But largely geographically, because, you know, I'm a history nerd, especially an ancient history nerd. The entire region that we know and call now the Middle East has been a place from which European and now American empires have found no end of misery. The Romans were never particularly good at it. Before them, Alexander's army marched through, conquered Persia, and then got swallowed by Persia. And Alexander took a run at Afghanistan and sort of won a little bit, but it never lasted. That is why there is an Iskander
province in Afghanistan and a town called Iskandaria. There are to this day in Iran, there are annual celebrations, holidays, in which the devil is represented as being Alexander. Not everybody thinks he was a great guy. In fact, a lot of cultures in that region think he was a European devil who came to impose his will upon people who had done precisely nothing to him, which is a valid way of looking at it. Enter us. Enter the British. Enter the French. There is something about going into the Middle East that just bedevils European and Western European-based nations. From the Greeks forward, we look at the conflict in Palestine and Israel, and we say, "Gee, why is there no solution?" Shh, don't tell anybody, but it's never been particularly peaceful there. And by this, I don't mean to make the tired old argument, them people's been fighting each other for thousands of years. What makes us think we're gonna do any different? Even though there's probably an element of truth to that. It's a place where cultures collide. And has been noted as such from just about the beginning of written documentation of same. If you treat some of the things in the Old Testament as being historical, and some few are, I think, you'll know that the little tiny speck of a nation, the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, got plumb run over by just about everybody in the neighborhood, whether it was the Egyptians, the Assyrians, or the Babylonians, or the Persians. Because conquest was the order of the day. Come forward into the era of Alexander the Great, not much difference. At that point in time, Persia had swallowed up all of the Middle East. It was the dominant peace-enforcing element of its age, to the point that Persia expanded across the Hellespont and onto the Greek mainland, the areas, well, the Peloponnese, the Corinthian Isthmus, you know, at the Attic Peninsula. Yeah. The Romans did their best to sort of rule at a distance, allowing kings to set themselves up over Judea. That would be your Herod family. Cleopatra looked somewhat longingly at the area and made as best of friends as she could with the Herod family. It didn't work out, however, and so the Roman Empire wound up crushing the area. 72 of the Common Era, I believe, is the date. And that is when Titus marches away with all the goodies. But nobody has ever successfully ruled the area in peace. And thus it remains even unto this day. And yet, and this is one of the questions for discussion, if I may. And yet, somewhere, sitting in the Pentagon, are a bunch of harumphing generals and admirals. Harumph! 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 Gentlemen, we've got to protect our phony baloney jobs. Harumph! Who either have or have not looked at history. And if they have looked at history, they have said, why, look at all that history of people failing to impose peace at a distance upon the Middle East. By God, we're smarter than they are. I mean, I wouldn't have all this hardware on my chest now if I wasn't smarter than them, would I? I mean, we got electricity and frisbees and wheat checks. Huh, we can do this. We've got a study group and a blue ribbon commission. We've got defense contractors and bombs that explode real good. We can do this. Or they haven't studied history, and they just sort of sit there picking their teeth with their toenail clippings. And why don't we just go conquer that for a little while? Shouldn't be a problem. There's more of us than there is of them. Better bombs. Better guns. And by God, we've got America and Jeebus on our side. And away we go. But whatever the process is by which we decide to go and do this stupid thing, and it is a stupid thing, it is a decision forced upon what strikes me as a reluctant president by a bunch of howler monkeys in the Congress and in the for-profit media who have decided that doing nothing, even if nothing is the best thing to do, is unacceptable because America, we do something, even if it's dumber than hell. And so we're going to begin bombing the snot out of portions of the Middle East. Well, not so much snot, but blood and brains and sinew and bones and guts and tendons and ligaments, mucus and phlegm, organs flying this way and that, and bodies that make a sort of splut noise when they're hit by various projectiles. And we're going to do it because we are the greatest nation on earth by Jeebus. Come on, really. You didn't expect me to support a stupid war just because a Democrat is waging it, did you? I'm anti-war. And no, I don't buy into, well, if we don't fight them over there, we're going to have to fight them over here. It was dumber than hell in 2003, and it's still dumber than hell. Remember the end of Joseph Heller's Catch-22, where Yossarian is rowing like mad in that little rubber inflatable lifeboat, he's going to row to Sweden? Well, that's sort of the vision that I have of ISIL coming to America, rowing madly on little blow-up rubber seahorse swimming pool floaties. But, of course, this being the 13th anniversary of September 11th, 2001, we have to be reminded that, well, they can get on airplanes, too. And that they can. But I think in the wake of September 11th, 2001, that we're a little bit better at airport security. I know this for a fact because my son is traveling right now. And he's got a bum knee. And he was kind of embarrassed by it, but he shared the story of it with me now that he's gotten where he's going. Hi, buddy, if you're listening. It happened down at Jaeger International Airport. Okay, I joke about the international part. I generally like Jaeger. But it's not just your average bought it at CVS knee brace. This is a knee brace that was provided to him by an actual orthopedic physician. It's serious. And because he knew he was going to be doing a ton of walking yesterday through the airports, I mean, my God, what a milk run. Charleston to Atlanta, Atlanta to Dallas, Dallas to Minneapolis, Minneapolis to North Dakota. He could have flown to Paris in less time. But he's got the knee brace on, and he puts his bag through the terrorism detector machine. And he walks through the body scanner, telling them in advance, I got this big old honking knee brace on. And, well, Ferg's a good, good, good young man. And not a bad looking one at that, if I dare say so myself. Rather a fit young fellow. So he tells him he's got a knee brace on. He goes through the thing. They see the knee brace on the human terrorism detector. Right? And they say, son, step over here for a minute. And his pant, his jeans, I think, had a rip in them. So they reach through there with one of their swabby things, and they swab his knee brace, and put it through their terrorism detector swab machine. And it goes ping, and everything's okay. Then the TSA guy looks at him and says, son, I'm going to need you to step over here behind the curtain. Or whom I had told, don't even make a joke around these people. They have had their humor glands removed. So he does. And he steps behind the curtain, and there's a young TSA guy there and an older TSA guy with glasses and a kind of a John Bolton mustache. The older guy says, drop your pants, son. You need to see the brace. So Ferg says, well, I can pull my leg up. No, son, we need you to drop trowel. And so he did. And they swabbed around on the brace and felt on the brace a little bit. And the older man looks up at him and says, did you buy this at the store or did some doctor give it to you? It's a prescribed medical device, sir, from an actual physician. I'm going to need you to take your shirt off, too, son. So he does. So he's standing there just in his, in his boxers and his brief. Yeah, standing there with his brace on his leg. And he just stands there for a while. While the guy with the John Bolton mustache and the glasses makes noises. Yeah. Really? So they eventually did, in fact, allow Ferg to put his clothes back on. The young guy seemed a little bit uneasy, but the old guy seemed to rather be enjoying it all. And let him go on his way. So it would appear that we have significantly upgraded our airline security, because nothing gets past these guys, especially not a fit young man with washboard abs and a knee brace. Yeah. But regardless, it's the abject water-boweled fear of a whole lot of very wealthy people who have managed to also terrorize a whole lot of ordinary people that have apparently caused us to decide to go and bomb in Iraq and perhaps Syria again. And we're not going to put boots on the ground. We're going to rely on freedom fighters for that. We're going to spend our money training up people who will probably drop their rifles and run at the first sign of trouble, as they have been doing through the advance of ISIL through the region. That's how ISIL has some of the really nifty weapons that it has. We built them. We make great stuff for killing people. And when you leave it on the ground, the people that you were trying to kill will pick it up and try to kill back with it. Truly a thorn in the side. But there's also this other thing that goes along with bombing brown people. And that is this. No matter how hard you try, and no matter how good a faith effort you make, sooner or later you're going to bomb somebody you didn't mean to. And depending on the degree of bombing in which one is engaging, one is going to bomb a lot of somebodies one didn't mean to. So, no matter how hard the Pentagon will try to keep the photographs from coming out, sooner or later there's going to be a picture of an old white-haired or a middle-aged white-haired man, or maybe he'll be a dark-haired man with a beard, holding the mutilated corpse of his 3-year-old daughter in his arms. From what we have done. We will justify this by saying, well, ISIL was killing them too, and cutting off their heads. Far better to just be killed than to be killed and then have your head cut off. Right? I mean, if you're going to be killed, be killed by the people who believe in freedom, than to be killed by the people who believe in a very violent Allah, and old Allah with his head lopping. Far better to be killed by people who believe in liberty. Sit, liberty, sit. Than to be killed by people who think that women ought not be learning to read. Jesus. Now we're going to do all this. And we are going to kill some civilians. And in point of fact, if past is prologue, thank you, Mr. Shakespeare, then we can probably, and there's anything to be learned from the prosecution of the war over in that region by Dim Leader, well, what was it? It was around Halloweenish of 2004. We'd been at it for about a year when the first study came out from Johns Hopkins University, which is not exactly the draw spunky school of science on the back of the matchbook, that said that in that short time, by October 2004, we had already created 1 million excess deaths in Iraq. That's 1 million civilians who would have been alive but for our invasion of their, emphasis on their, country. God only knows how much higher that number went. Dim Leader had been at war for a year and a half, and he had already managed to kill 1/6 of the number of people that were murdered in the Holocaust. 1/6 the number of innocent civilians were killed in a year and a half of the Iraq War as were killed in the whole of the Second World War and the Holocaust appended thereunto. Is there anybody silly enough to think that just because a Democrat is leading this latest incarnation of warfare, that we won't do that or something similar again? Is there anybody who thinks that that number got that high because of boots on the ground? Now, no doubt, we killed some people in the ground invasion of Iraq in 2003 that would not have otherwise been killed. But we had us a humdinger of an air war. And remember, in the decade or so that had gone between Bush War One and Bush War Two, what was it? How many hundreds of thousands? Was it a million dead Iraqi children as a result of the sanctions? And that's before we even start doing silly things like counting the number of birth defects and stillbirths that happened as a result of depleted uranium munitions. So that's what apparently, I mean, all of that is stuff that was not said last night. But it was embedded in the text. It was sort of a Trojan, if you will. Trojan. How many people out there who hear the word Trojan now, and we're discounting the ones who immediately think of latex or non-latex based prophylactic contraceptive aids? How many people hear the word Trojan and think of a malicious piece of computer code? And stop there. Without understanding that a Trojan in computer code, in the description for a piece of malicious computer code, refers back to one of those most ancient pieces of storytelling, which of course is also a deeply complicated way of trying to understand the world around them, to wit, the Iliad, attributed to Homer, but certainly the product of hundreds of years of storytelling from the barbarian Bronze Age past of the people we refer to as Greeks and Trojans. Now, it used to really get under our friend Philip in Australia's skin when I would mention that there is sort of a cockamamie alternative theory that says that the Trojan War didn't even happen in that region at all, but that it was an even older Celtic tale coming down from a war between the mainland Europe and the island of Britain. But we won't go there. It's a Trojan horse. The Trojan horse. A country that is perfectly well protected and absolutely unable to be attacked or overcome, which in its hubris, in its pride, allows voluntarily within its city gates the engine of its own demise. Wily, crafty Odysseus, who has the Achaeans, the Danaans, you know, they're never called the Greeks in the Iliad. Build a big Trojan horse, because the horse was apparently the deity of the Trojans. So they build this big horse and they leave it outside the city gates of Troy. And inside the city gates, Priam and all his counselors begin to discuss, well, whatever shall we do? Whatever shall we do about this offering to our deity? whence comes the ancient line? Because by then, you see, all the forces we would understand as Greek have disappeared. They've gotten in their ships and they've rowed away. And the 10 years, the 10 long, tortured, trying, blood-soaked, miserable years of the Trojan War appear to be at an end. With a horse left at the gates, a great big horse on wheels, like a giant child's toy. And we get the phrase, beware of Greeks bearing gifts. And that's not a slur on, it's out of their book. Because, of course, everybody wasn't gone. The Achaean equivalent of special forces, SEAL Team 6, hoo-ah, were inside the belly of the Trojan horse. And when the smart people were overruled by the stupid people, and the horse gets wheeled inside, and they begin the celebration of, hoo-ah, we done won the war, and there's all kinds of dancing and flute tootling and lyre plucking and what have you, pluck them. Then Odysseus and his wily SEAL Team 6 crawl out of the belly of the horse, and in an effort to put an end to a war that was 10 years old, whose origins they scarcely even remembered and had not seen their home in 10 long years, and so many of their comrades were dead, they put the torch to the city that could not otherwise have been taken. You know, there's a lesson there for anybody who wants to sort of dope it out. A lesson indeed. Things can come into your country that aren't what you think they are and can wreak absolute havoc. Think back to the election of 1980, for those of you who were around then. And how a greasy-headed old B-movie actor who sort of talked in a kindly old grandfatherly way about patriotism and how great America is and exceptionalism and, Mommy, I'd like some ketchup. And it talks about a shining city on a hill and America and mourning. It was all one great big Trojan horse. And we brought it within our body politic, and it got loose, and it ran all over the place, wreaking havoc, and wreaks havoc unto this day. And the toxic vector for all of that poison is revered by a significant plurality of this nation as a great president. The city is burning. And yes, in this nation, the women do weep. They weep in profusion. And yes, that nation which had been until then impregnable finds itself cowering in fear. And lashing out of its own fear, and out of its own ignorance. And that Trojan horse was born by no foreign power. It was done deliberately by an act of sublime internal sedition. It was done by the Republican Party. The nature of wall building is such that a wall can be strengthened so that it may not be breached from the outside, but it is much easier to knock down from the inside. And this they have done. Lord God. And so last night we heard the latest incarnation. Of our response to the Trojan horse that was brought into our midst. And while I do not get into the prognosticating game, I don't think this is prognostication. I don't see any more good coming of what we're doing and about to do at the cost of millions upon millions upon millions of dollars than any good has come from previous attempts at it. If you watched President Notshore's speech, you know that it had a lot of the same old palaver in it about how we're better than them and they're no good. And oddly enough, if there was any entertainment value in what went on last night, it lay in watching the right wing twist itself into a pretzel, trying to figure out how they can possibly enjoy the war and the blood sacrifice for which they truly live, and at the same time continue to hate that dark-skinned man who was going to get their much-desired war on for them. I was sitting here minding my own business when someone, I forget who, said, "Oh, my God, they have brought John McCain on to MSNBC." And they had. And they had. Later on, I watched reruns on the electric computer box. And I saw that, of course, there are some mainstream Democrats who have, we need to do this. We absolutely have to do this. We got to do this. You know, freedom. Wolverines! And I largely think that voices that say, "Hey, you know what? War is not a good idea. Why don't we let them solve their problems? Because Merkel, we're going to be drowned out again." And we're going to do this again. And we're not going to do it right. One of the central portions of the right-wing response to all of this is for the Congress to try to sneak out of town before anybody can make them vote on giving the authority to the President of the United States to do this. Under the War Powers Act, which itself is an abdication of congressional authority, under the War Powers Act, President Obama can bomb the living bejesus out of just about anywhere on the planet for 60 days before he has to go to Congress again. This is what the repiglickens in the Congress would prefer happen. That way, if it goes great, they can say, "We were with you all the time," and if it goes poorly, they can say, "See, that one in our White House cannot be trusted to run a war." Hint, no matter how wildly successful it goes, it will go poorly as far as the repiglickens are concerned, while they quietly and in behind closed doors hop up and down and play with each other and celebrate the bloodshed, because they worship at an altar that is soaked in blood. And so we come back around then on this thorn in the side Thursday to the question I was going to ask. Isn't there a structure? Isn't there a process, isn't there a procedure by which this republic goes about the business of waging war? Isn't it, in fact, embodied in the Constitution of the United States? What's wrong with using that process embodied in the Constitution of the United States? The framers, and I feel confident in saying this, having listened for so long and I hope attentively to Dr. Bill. Oh, I got it. Okay, I see it. Carol in the chat room noting, yes, Bob, there is a process and there is a procedure, but only when the president is white. President Blackenstein is on his own. Yeah. Sadly true. But there is a process. Oh, and just as an aside, because we've been putting up with it for 13 years now, it was one of those things that arrived on in our national consciousness alongside the information crawler at the bottom of the screen that we had not seen until this day 13 years ago. The word homeland. If it is, and it won't be, but if it is a million years before I hear another president use the words, our homeland, the homeland, it will be too damn soon. And I know, I'm marking myself out as some sort of constitutional curmudgeon. But that word was creepy when the Bush administration insisted on beginning to use it. And it's still creepy. For reasons not the least of which are that this is not the homeland. There is not an ethnic identity known as Merkins. I mean, there are. But we really don't ask them for the real Merkins. We don't ask them for their input on these decisions, often, if at all. If your ancestry is it comes from somewhere besides this continent in the last, 400 years or so, this is not the homeland. Now, if you are Anishinaabe, if you are Haudenosaunee, if you are Cherokee, if you are Apache, Navajo, Diné, Hopi, then this is the homeland. Of course, if you're all of those things, then me and us, we, European and Asian and African, to one degree or another, are, invaders of the homeland. And this is a 500-year-old occupation. This is not the homeland. This is a republic. That is how the framers and the founders of this country, up until the second generation and third generation of this nation, referred to this place. This was the republic. Coming from the Latin res publica, the public thing. This is the union of several states. Formed together and gathered by Constitution to work on the constant job of self-improvement. This is the Union. This is the nation. This is the United States. This is not the goddamn homeland. These are not the wild and grassy steppes from which our ancients arose. Well, I mean, they are, but we're not the ones who have any ancients who arose upon them. In the word homeland, I see, I hear another slap in the face at the people from whom we took this country. And honest to God, I don't understand why the Obama administration has persisted in using that noxious Orwellian term, homeland. It's icky. When is the last time, and then I'm asking questions, these are not rhetorical, can a Democratic president not use the term the Republic because it sounds too much like Republican? Now, we use the bullshit term our democracy all the time when this country is not now, nor has it ever been a democracy or even remotely attempted it. Democracy in this country having ever been aspirational and not operational. I guess we can't call it, as Abraham Lincoln did and people of his era, the Union, because that would piss off the right to work people, even though that is also what we are. To call ourselves America is a little bit insulting to everybody in, say, Canada, Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Costa Rica, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Panama, Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and I'm leaving some out, and not to mention the Caribbean. But the homeland, for me, because I have an image-driven brain, it conjures up some utterly false notion that we, in our distant past, you know, our distant white past, were riding around, you know, carrying our yurts behind us. I love yurts. I want a yurt. What would it take to create the pushback? I mean, I still want that cabinet level post created of the Secretary of Jesus, Barack! Kind of peering over his shoulder, reading the speech. Jesus, Barack, are you really going to say homeland?
Well, I had thought that people seemed to respond well to that. I mean, that is what we began to call ourselves 13 years ago.
Jesus, Barack! You're using dipshit's language!
Well, I hardly think that is called for.
But all that aside, there really is a process by which we go about in this country, in this republic, in this union, to go about the business of making war. And it is not complicated. The president makes a determination that there's somebody out there we would prefer that they actually be a threat to us, who are already making war against us, and he in turn goes to the Congress and says, there are people out there that are being mean to us, and I would like for y'all to discuss whether or not we should go to war, and I will abide by your decision. You do realize that some of these processes that are in the Constitution and are rather significantly different from
European models in times past might very well have been based upon decisional models that we had witnessed in action among the native peoples whose land we were stealing? Yes, absolutely. Among the indigenous peoples of this country, one could not simply take the band, the tribe, the group, the alliance to war without a damn fine discussion of why one was doing it. And you see, a president is one person, no matter how many advisors that president may have. A president is one person, whereas the two bodies of the Congress are specifically designed for the purpose of debating the weighty issues of the day. So that those people who represent all of the people in the country may themselves express the sentiment of the people whom they represent. And that's why Congress winds up with the power to declare war, not the president. Congress is, after all, going to be on the hook for funding it and passing the laws necessary to its successful prosecution. But the Congress has abdicated that responsibility. See, there's another little problem here, and that is that the authorization for use of military force that's been in operation for most of the time over the last 13 years it specifically allows the targeting of Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda is kind of the focus of the OMF. There's a problem here, though. Al-Qaeda itself has looked at ISIS-ISIL and said, those fuckers are crazy. We want nothing to do with them. We disavow them. They're a bunch of heretics. We hate them. They're ruining the brand. And we got nothing in this. So really, there's nothing in the OMF for President Not Sure to hang his hat on, despite the fact that he said, I'm sure I have the authority to do this. Well, the authority he has is under the War Powers Act, and that's good for 60 days. We're not going to finish this in 60 days. We're not going to finish this, brothers and sisters, in 60 years. We have reached that point that James Madison was warning against. We are in a state of perpetual warfare, and our freedoms have gone by the boards. And I even use that term freedoms advisedly because it has been turned into such an obnoxious and odious thing by the people who walk around in tricorn hats with tea bags hanging from them and carrying signs that say, get your government hands off my Medicare, and Obama is the Antichrist. Yeah. So that is the filibobster for this evening, this Thorn in the Side Thursday. We certainly have an abundance of things to talk about. Oh, well, Robert in Morgantown making a trenchant observation. They have to use homeland because motherland and fatherland were already taken by others that wanted to build empires. It's the absolute truth. The person land. The parent land. Oh, God. Oh, Mr. Orwell. Tim with a question via email. Subject line, attacking ISIS.
Bob, you have a law degree and you're extremely smart. Okay, yes, I have a law degree. I don't know that I'm going to buy into that second clause. What does ISIL, a group the U.S. trained and supported, like Al-Qaeda, have anything to do with today's memorial event? You know, 9/11? Because they're them. News Ninja Gene pointing out Trojan deity Poseidon was the Trojan patron, patron deity. Gene says, though, I have heard that the Poseidon reference was an earthquake. No. Gene is correct. Poseidon was the patron deity. However, and a lot of people forget this, Poseidon was manifested not only as the god of the sea, but also the god of horses. Mm-hmm. And a little reminder before we go to the break, this is Thursday, and of course we have the Green News Report on the way. After that, we'll open up the phone lines. You know the number, of course, I presume, unless 304-574-8178. That's the phone number, 304-574-8178. If, on the other hand, you would prefer to use the Skype-to-Skype method, my contact on Skype is Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, Horn, H-O-R-N, Bob Kincaid Horn. If you've never made contact that way, just shoot me a contact request, and we'll be off and running. As we've proven a couple of times over the last few nights, being new to calling the program is not an impediment to participation. Nobody's going to hustle you off the air here. We're going to have time to talk things out to the degree which you feel necessary. That's why we call what we do here Conversation Radio. The conversation that we do here is also entirely listener community supported. There are no underwriting grants from Amalgamated Blasting Cap or the Acme Corporation proudly providing bombs with which to blow children into their constituent tiny, tiny parts in the Middle East. Mm-mm. None of that. It is strictly a matter of listener support. And this evening, thanks very much to Roger and to Linda and to Anthony. We finished last night in a little tiny bit of a hole, but we're okay now. So we start the evening at our regular $150 per evening fundraising goal. And if you would like to be part of the process whereby we ensure that this effort continues into the immediate future, well, we operate on a month-to-month basis, and however you choose to help, whether it be $5 at a time, or $150 at a time, or, you know, what a... Oh, Mr. Gates! Mr. Soros! Ain't gonna happen. But no, we try to raise $150, and that means 15 folks at 10, 10 folks at 15, 30 people at 5, 3 at 50, 6 at 25, 2 at 75. However you prefer to help us keep this going, any help and all help is profoundly appreciated. You will find the PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com, where you will also find, if you prefer to operate via the traditional mails, you will find the mailing address. I will repeat it now. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y-W-V 25801, with a reminder that checks and money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid, as Bob Kincaid does not deal with them, nor even see them. They should be made payable to the Horn or Head on Communications, because that's what makes it easy on Boss Man Wayne when he takes off his spider-proof gloves and reaches into the box and takes whatever is in there and sends it on down the road. And by the way, thank you very much to our good friend Tom in the Bay Area, who helped out with the hole we were in last week. It was much appreciated. So there we are, $150 to go in the remaining hour and 55 minutes of the program. Any help is magnificent help. By the way, if you've never been to the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room,
I encourage you to jump right in. We've got a great group in there this evening. Good evening, Anatole. Good evening, John. Good evening, Kathy. Good evening, M. Brandt and Mr. Gibson and R. Kellison and Sam and WV and Stockton Larry and Texas T and Tim from L.A. and Todd and Waggy and Will in Chicago. Good evening. See, you'll have lots of fun people to hang out with if you pop over to headonradionetwork.com. And in the meantime, a little break. Like I said, the Green News Report is on the way from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. I always look forward to Tuesdays and Thursdays. I wish. I do. I really do. I wish they had the wherewithal to make this a five-night-a-week affair. I also wish that the media player was not so thoroughly misbehaving, but we can't have everything we want now, can we? This is Conversation Radio. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn.
Took the Union Jack, and Maggie over lunch one day took a cruiser with all hands, apparently to make him give it back. Down your dead.
their favorite toy. They'll be good girls and boys in the French Memorial, home for colonial wasters. Life and live is every morning. Are you having a nice time? Now the final solution can be applied.
It's Thursday, September 11th, don't be frightened, 2014.
You're going the wrong way!
What?
You're going the wrong way!
Greenhouse gas emissions jump at the highest rate ever recorded.
To date, Tony Abbott has made Australia the first country in the world to reverse action on climate change.
Australia's emissions jump after carbon tax axed just 2 months ago. Oceans acidifying at a rate not seen in 300 million years, plus some good news.
Thank you.
The ozone layer is bouncing back.
All of that bad news and a little tiny bit of good news and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Boy, with all the terrible things in the world, we'll all be underwater in 200 years anyway, so who cares?
Well, there's that. Feel better? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, for the last several weeks or even months, we've been reporting on extreme weather, huge downpours all over the U.S., all over the rest of the world. And now we have, in early September, 14 inches of snow in Calgary. Is this more of the same, changing climate patterns all across the globe?
It sure seems like it. It'll take time for scientists to find out for sure. But yeah, it does seem global warming is turbocharging the weather. I mean, how many freak storms do people need to see before they decide to do something about it?
Apparently a lot.
And it doesn't seem to be getting much better. UN scientists warned in a new report this week that levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere rose at the fastest rate ever recorded. That's according to the World Meteorological Organization, that says CO2 emissions rose in 2013 at the fastest rate in 30 years.
So we seem to be learning absolutely nothing?
It does appear to be that way. The WMO also says it appears that perhaps the Earth's natural carbon sinks might be reaching their saturation point. Carbon dioxide is now 142% higher than it was in pre-industrial times. The WMO warns we are, quote, running out of time to cut emissions and avoid the worst impacts of climate change.
Natural carbon sinks reaching their saturation point. What does that mean?
That means the ocean and plants, things that naturally absorb carbon dioxide in our system, are starting to lose their capacity to absorb all the carbon dioxide we have dumped into the atmosphere.
They have taken in as much as they can. The rest is going to just continue floating around out there?
They do suspect that might be the case.
Wow.
And the report also finds that the surge in CO2 is acidifying the oceans at a rate not seen in 300 million years. Now, the oceans, again, naturally absorb some of our CO2 emissions, but too much CO2 actually changes ocean chemistry, and that ultimately can kill coral reefs and ocean plants and animals that live at the bottom of the ocean food chain.
And that matters why?
Well, if you kill off the bottom of the ocean food supply, that affects everything that we like to eat that's farther up the ocean food chain. Meanwhile, in Australia, a new study shows just 2 months after the Conservative Abbott administration repealed Australia's successful carbon tax on its largest industrial polluters, Australia's emissions have shot up again. The carbon tax had reduced Australia's emissions by 7% and slashed household electricity rates. But now, according to Vice.com, all proposed solar farms in Australia are on hold because investors are uncertain about the future of Australia's renewable energy sector.
They taxed industry for polluting, and that decreased the amount of pollution. Then they removed the tax, and it increased the amount of pollution, and it killed efforts for alternative energy that doesn't pollute.
Right.
Just as those who opposed killing that landmark tax had predicted.
Yep. Now, some good news.
And not a moment too soon.
A new NASA report finds that the planet's protective ozone layer is actually recovering.
Right now, the countries of the world report that there are zero
emissions of carbon tetrachloride.
Scientists first realized back in the 1970s that we were destroying the Earth's protective ozone layer with industrial chemicals called CFCs. World governments overcame fierce industry opposition to phase out those CFCs in the Montreal Protocol of 1987, the world's first international climate treaty, led by Ronald Reagan, Senior George Bush, and Margaret Thatcher.
Tree huggers.
We now know, too, that great damage is being done to the ozone layer by the production of halons and chlorofluorocarbons. But at least we have recognized that reducing and eventually stopping the emission of CFCs is one positive thing we can do about the menacing accumulation of greenhouse gases.
So working together with the world, creating a treaty, putting caps on emissions, actually works, and it doesn't destroy the world economy?
That's correct. The ozone hole is, quote, well on track for full recovery by 2050. And when you think about it, it is scary just how close we came to destroying it before we even realized we were doing it.
And how about the UN, who oversaw all of this? Have they taken the world and thrown us all into prison camps yet?
No, as a matter of fact, they haven't.
Just wait for it. For all of that and more, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help the Green News Report stay on the air through good news and bad. We just like telling you the truth for a change. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
And here we are back in the second hour of the program, 18 minutes after 7 p.m. here in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone. Before going to the phone, see, I'm learning, phone, a note that came in from Philip, actually came in last night at post-program, but I wanted to share it with you today because it sort of dovetails with, what we've been talking about this hour. Philip writes, I wish we would stop saying that our youth joined the military because of patriotic reasons in wartime. More often, they have been persuaded of the rightness of the cause by misinformation, propaganda, and jingoism. The most recent two generations in my family have joined the military, and frankly, it was just as much for career opportunities and direction in their young lives as it was out of patriotism. I'm not opposed to military service. However, the argument that those who serve do so out of patriotism too often creates a dichotomy in which those who oppose the war and refuse to serve are imprisoned, engage in service as conscientious objectors, or protest the atrocity of war, are labeled as un-American and deficient in patriotism. My 20-year-old cousin was killed in Vietnam after Nixon was elected, in part because of his secret peace plan. I'm weary of those who honor him in death with his name on the wall and ignored his needs as a young man who dropped out of high school and enlisted to fight as a Marine because he was duped into believing doing so was patriotic. As for the draft, I've always supported it because I'm weary of poor European and African Americans, Asian Americans, Hispanics, and American Indians bearing the burden for others. But I would also argue that the first to go should be those in Congress. If they can serve their constituencies while in Washington, then they can do so from elsewhere, such as on the front, while their staffs work on the home front. The logistics on voting from the front lines can be worked out in this age of technological innovation. I'm weary of John McCain and others wanting to scar another generation because they suffered the horror of war. While I'm venting, Philip says, I'm sickened by private charities formed to aid our wounded warriors. If we wanted to aid our returning veterans, we would gladly pay more taxes to do so, and everyone would be compelled to contribute if they qualified as taxpayers. The notion that the government isn't doing enough to rehabilitate and treat returning veterans is unacceptable, and we should be deeply ashamed because it attests to the deficiencies and lack of responsibility of our representatives and us as a nation. So it goes in 21st century America. And Philip has so many good points in there. Thank you, Philip. First of all, war is a shared risk of a nation involving shared sacrifice and shared success if war can be deemed to be successful.
We do not engage in that. We do not believe that any longer. Since I've been playing around in the fields of ancient history this evening anyway, well, a certain empire called Rome got itself in deep trouble because, and it stopped being a republic and went toward empire when it left its essential... Rome had no standing armies. Our framers, our founders wanted no standing armies. Got them anyway. What happened was that when it was wartime, the rituals would be observed in front of the Temple of Mars, and the citizens of the Republic, see, Republic, would then arm and march off to war. Everybody. Well, no, not everybody, because only citizens could do it. This kept the patrician class in check by means of making sure that everybody had a stake in it and that it was not casually and callously entered into. It also meant that the patrician class, who were usually the officer class, the leadership, were under a solemn duty not to fritter away the lives of the people who would feed the Republic through their family farms. This all changes in the 2nd century BCE when, out of a sense of desperation, after a massive slaughter, non-citizens... See, in order to qualify for the legions, just to be, you know, a marching legionnaire, you had to provide your own armor and your own arms, your shield, your sword, your spear, what have you. If you wanted to ride a horse, you had to bring your own horse. Shared risk, shared sacrifice, shared reward. We no longer do that. Philip is absolutely correct. We wage war on the backs of poor European, African Americans, Asian Americans, Hispanics, and American natives who join an all-volunteer military, and that all-volunteer military is a sham anyway because, well, it's been referred to as the poverty draft because it is. People want to go get their war on? Let's get it on as a nation. Yeah. And thanks, by the way, thanks go out to Anthony. Thank you, Anthony, for getting us started this evening. Anthony says, thank you again, Bob, for thought-provoking radio. I need it. I know it's not much, but I hope it helps. It is more than you can imagine. It is, Anthony, and it does help indeed. So we are off and running on our evening's goal. A few more, and we'll be rocking and rolling right along. Hey, let's go to the phone. Welcome to the program.
What's up, Bob?
Hey, Jim.
Yeah, man, you are definitely right. What do they call it? Those private charities where you see the injured guy having really
bad. Oh yeah, and people like Hannity are involved in them. And of course, Hannity makes a tasty little. Well, he wets his beak.
Yeah, I have no doubt. I don't trust those things at all. And it's like it's just this downside. You know, no taxes for the rich. But, you know, and then they try and guilt people into feeling sorry for the wars they go choose to propagate and invade, you know, start up the occupations. It really gets my goat, you know. I mean, it's pretty, you know, pretty effed up. You know, it's just like, also I concur 100% with the bullshit term homeland. It sounds, and when I first heard it, if I remember correctly, that sounded so much like fatherland. And they had to know, not him per se, you know, the one of your favorite leaders, Bush 2, They had to know that, but then they just, I guess they just figured, and I've never seen anybody in the media, even, you know, the liberal media, at least, you know, I'll call it, goes, for as MSNBC, maybe, on some website, I'm sure on websites they pointed it out, but, that's just crazy to me, you know, I mean, but you'll never see it on NBC, ABC, da, 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 you know, usual characters, and definitely not Fox. You know. So,
right.
And it's like Goddess of Irony. Oh, I'm thinking about the Goddess of Irony and Karma. I guess they're kind of the same thing. You know, I mean, because karma can be like it's not necessarily a religious thing. It's almost like a law of physics, you know. You know, you think, you know, you push something, you know, what is it? You push something and it pushes back, you know?
Yeah. And, and you might find this interesting, Jim. I saw something pop in during the Green News report. Via CNN, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt, I guess. This news bulletin from CNN cites to, of course, those truth tellers over at the CIA. Wait a minute, I have to get my CNN voice on here. Hold on. There are between 20,000 and 31,500 ISIS fighters across Iraq and Syria, at least double previous estimates. We were going to have us some war and everything, but now we're going to have to have, I mean, we're going to have some serious war. I mean, there's 31,500, and every one of them's got him a head lopping knife. And they're just looking for heads to lop. Because they're the only people in world history who have ever beheaded anybody. Oh, wait, we're going to train the Syrian opposition fighters over there in the sacred sand of our buddies, the Saudi head loppers.
Yeah, well, I mean, France? Yeah, the guillotine was pretty popular, and I'm wondering exactly, and I was going to ask you about that, where the lopping off of heads originated from. Was that a quote-unquote Christian thing?
It's certainly the Muslims didn't invent it. I mean, they're, with the exception of the Mormons, as far as major religions go, well, the Mormons and the Sikhs, they're kind of the Johnny-come-latelys on the block anyway. They've only been around ruining people's minds since, you know, the 7th century of the current era. Whereas Christianity goes back a full 20 centuries, and the other Abrahamic monotheistic religion goes back to the Bronze Age. You know, Judaism, which arose out of, you know, the Hebrew faith, which came from, and Abram left Ur of the Chaldees carrying his poor old daddy on his back. Oh, wait, that was Aeneas carrying. Never mind. But anyway, yeah. Head lopping, I'm not, is there, somebody, I need a classic scholar here, or an ancient literature scholar. Is there any head lopping in the Epic of Gilgamesh? Is there any reference to somebody getting their head lopped off in the Code of Hammurabi? Because I know, this much I do recall, just right off the top of my head, absent any research, Jim, I know that if you go to the Old Testament, you'll find that, now granted, David slew Goliath by hitting him in the head with a rock from a sling. But after he killed Goliath, he went and mutilated his corpse by lopping off his head, if I recall correctly. Because I remember being a little boy being read my Bible stories thinking, ooh, that's icky. Cool.
Yeah, no, I was just wondering because Islam is, what, 700-800 years younger than Christianity.
Islam is 1,400 years old.
Right. And so they're going through their, I don't see much hope for them, but then again, I don't see much hope for Christianity. People really believe in it, although somehow we got this country founded. But I mean, even now, you know, trying to make it a religious free, or not so much religious free, a free, you know, free, you don't have to join this cult or that cult. But it seems like they're constantly trying to, recruit on, you know, your favorite show, Pat Robinson, and, Clayton Smith, whatever, you know, and I'm sure even the mild-mannered Catholics with their little pedophile, recruitment camps, you know, called Catholic schools. That's just the way it goes. But what I was going to also say was I was trying to send that money for the, I'm going to still send it, but I was having trouble with my computer.
No worries.
Murphy's Law, but it's coming in. Save me some of those goodies. And, I think that's it. Yeah, I basically covered everything. I think I'm going to let somebody else get through. I was glad to hear. I mean, I just sort of topped my little book thing, because sometimes if I'm going to talk, yeah, sometimes it helps to have like a little cheat sheet. But, you reminded me, I mean, because I've been thinking it, because I hate that goddamn commercial about the Wounded Warrior crap. And I'm like, what the fuck? Pardon my French. Are we paying for that poor SOB's injuries when it should be corporate fucking America?
Well, no. Well, see, I won't even, I understand your sentiment completely, Jim, but it shouldn't be corporate America. It should be corporate America, but it should be all of us. That's what I was saying about the concept of warfare being shared risk, shared sacrifice. We're all on the hook for what we go and do militarily. I mean, wasn't that sort of the lesson out of Nuremberg? You know, not to run down that road with that guy or anything, but and history teaches that lesson again and again and again.
You know what?
It doesn't just exist inside the military. I'm going to be really shallow here for a minute, Jim. I've been pissed off for 18 years. Well, I have actually more than. When our children here entered the public school system, and this is not specific to West Virginia, I'm sure it happens all over the country. When our kids started public school, I think they were kindergartners the first time they were sent home with a little sheet of paper saying, "Now get your little tyke to sell this so that we can have money for classroom supplies or art supplies or what have you." And it used to be that I would just send $100. I would wad the thing up, throw it in the garbage, put $100 in an envelope, and send it with my child to school and say, "Don't bother. Don't send another one of those goddamn..." Okay. I didn't say, "Don't send another one of those things home with my child. My child is there to learn, not hustle merchandise." And it's the same principle. If we really believe in public education, then we fully fund public education. And we don't send five-year-olds toddling out a godforsaken one-lane winding road in Appalachia trying to get somebody to buy a tin of cookies. Sorry, not yelling at you.
I got you.
And by the same token, we don't ask people to text "rip me off" to, you know, the Wounded Warrior Project so Sean Hannity can have a ride on a Learjet. We fully fund the Veterans Administration, and we make it work. Because, see, Jim, that's the other thing. I'm sorry, soapbox, me, can't be helped. Your fault! The reason we have the problems that we have inside government agencies and entities that are designed to serve the people is because of this notion that has been promulgated wildly by the right wing in this country, that there is a gulf that exists between the people and the government. One of the most successful tactics that has been deployed by the right wing in this country is to make people think that they are not the government, that they are not sovereign, that they are not self-governing. Because there through much of our history, we have not been that way. My high school educated parents graduating from Anstead High School in 1943 felt very much that this was their country, that they had a role to play in it, that they were an important part of it, and that they damned well had a voice in how it should be run. Bless her heart, my mother was a letter writer. And not wacky tinfoil hat. It was part of her civic duty. She would find an issue that mattered to her, and she would get pen and paper out and write to the congressman. She didn't feel like she was being goofy. She actually felt like she was taking part in government and fulfilling a solemn and sacred secular duty, civic duty. But beginning with, and this is why I get pissed off, Jim, with people on the so-called left. Ha! What left? Who say things like and you find it in the third party people most of all, bless their hearts, they're well meaning, but they say there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. Well, yes, there is. There's a rather profound difference between the two parties, and that goes back to a man named George Wallace and another man named Strom Thurmond, both of whom said there's not a dime's worth of difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. So actually, a lot of the third party people are getting, they don't realize it because they don't know any goddamn history, but they're getting in bed with George Wallace and Strom Thurmond. And I'm sorry if I'm going to piss off some members of the Horn family, but it just is what it is. When Ralph Nader said there was no difference between Democrats and Republicans, he was echoing George goddamn Wallace and Strom fucking Thurmond.
No, I agree. And it's just like, I mean, the way I look at it, if the true election results had come to play in 2000 and Kevin Munoz, Gore. If Gore had won, like he was supposed to, should have.
Like he did.
I don't even think nothing would have happened. So then, you know, it's like the Robert Frost going the road and taking, you know, if we don't get into this goddamn invasion occupation crap, imagine how different things.
Yeah. I mean, this country is falling apart, and yet, and no matter how many places where you point out that this country is falling apart, there is always a Republican there to say, "Well, we can't afford it," or "That's more of them liberal social programs." Whoever imagined that having paved roads would be a godforsaken liberal social program? But there's a Republican there to say, "We can't afford it." You know, and again, as I pointed out the other day, Jim, you know, there's Hal Rogers, who presides over the second most physically ill congressional district in the United States, in Kentucky's fifth, saying that no, we can't afford $88 million to try to put the brakes on Ebola in West Africa. But you know what? He's gonna, if he's asked for money, he's gonna jump right out there and say, "I support the troops, and we will write a blank damn check for however many bombs, Tomahawk cruise missiles, drone hellfire missiles." That suddenly, that ability to just, you know how the Republicans are and the little libertarians and the teabaggers and all those asshats are always running around, "Well, the government can't just print money." Well, all of a sudden, we're just going to print money because we're getting our war on, baby.
Yep. Well, it's just like, if you just cut the write-offs, which are written by the corporations that get them for corporate America, and a lot of them defense contractors and big corporations, the budget problem isn't a problem. And it's like, and not only that, people's taxes would probably go down if corporations were taxed like Eisenhower, like 91% after the first $1 million or whatever it was. And even then, they didn't seem to have a problem keep making money, you know? And then stop this offshoring. So, you know, he's pretty about that. Okay, you want to be, establish a country somewhere, of your company in another country? Fine. Then we'll just tax the hell out of you when you, you know, like an import. And this free trade crap, well, I'm getting on a little crazy rant.
No, but no, yeah. see how you can run down, right down the road? And again, you know, we don't have a lot of experts on this program, Jim. We have ordinary Americans like my mom and dad, like you, like the folks in the chat room, like everybody who can figure this stuff out, because it isn't rocket science. We can figure this out, but lo and behold, I don't know. Maybe once you get your brain washed in corporate money, when you cross the beltway into D.C., everything looks different.
I guess that's like the Greek river.
The river Styx.
Dead, you know. Yeah, where you just lose your memory, right? Isn't that what happened?
Yeah, I think you may be right.
Yeah.
I mean, this really, I mean, we talk about it being, but it isn't. This really could be the greatest country in the world. This really could be the greatest country the world has ever known. But we're more interested in bombs and bullets.
It's not just that. We could do so much for each other, too, but, I mean, that's just out of a capitalist. I mean, you'd have to have more of a democratic socialist situation, and that's, you know, I mean, you even mentioned the word socialism, and people, you know, they flip out, or they're clueless, you know. So, well, on that cheery note, I'm going to get some.
Well, yeah, and you know what? You kind of inspired one of your fellow Louisianans.
Yeah?
Yeah, just got a note from Jack in Shreveport. Subject line.
I like Jack.
Yeah, Jack's a good guy. People versus government separation. Jack says, today I heard Flimball telling a caller that he should thank his neighbors that were subsidizing his health care, as if the caller has never subsidized some expense for somebody else, and as if there is no public good or public commons. Disgusting ass.
That's what they want to do, and believe me, it's working really well. I just noticed from people I know and DNA sharers of mine, i.e. family people I know.
Yeah, and Randy in PA pointing out, he said I took a recent sample year of the U.S. budget, and one-third of the outlay was defense-related. Out of a $3.6 trillion U.S. budget, approximately $1.2 trillion was defense-related. The U.S. spends more on defense than the next 13 countries combined. You used to be able to see this on the back cover of the paper Form 1040 instructions in the form of a pie chart, but nearly everything is online now, and that has disappeared.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to let you go, let somebody else get on, and I'll figure that out. You'll have that 100 and get me those yummy hot pink. What is it?
No. This time you're going after the smoky ghost pepper cheese.
Exactly. I'll figure that out. I don't know.
All right. No worries. No worries, Jim.
I think it's the goddess of irony screwing with me.
Well, that's how it
works. That's what it is.
All right. You take it easy, Jim. Bye now. Our buddy Jim calling from Louisiana Stan. And, yeah, just a reminder that if you would like to try the smoky ghost pepper cheese, or if you, in fact, would like to try the jalapeno pistachios, one or the other. They won't both fit in the same box. Sparky has continued his offer. Anybody wants to kick in a $100 contribution, he will gladly provide you with a package of your choice of smoky ghost pepper cheese or jalapeno pistachios, and they're both just freaking wonderful. I mean, they're just downright yummy. I'm partial to the smoky ghost pepper cheese, though, because those little beads of sweat form right along your hairline, wowzer. So here's how it works. If you want to take advantage of that, shoot me a note.
And he'll say, with your note, send me your mailing address, and I'll provide that to Sparky, and then you'll have it. And Sparky has extended this for folks who want to do that in an effort to take care of fundraising and maybe get a little bit out front, because we're always going to have those in the hole days. So there it is, $100, the Sparky $100 smoky ghost pepper cheese jalapeno pistachio challenge, because people seem interested in this. And I'd never had smoky ghost pepper cheese or jalapeno pistachios, and everything is now different, without a doubt. By the way, Marty pointed out, one of my colleagues is helping one of her sons sell candy bars at work in order to help fund band instruments, because music, among the other arts, is not one of those three R's that gets taught. I didn't know basketball and football started with an R. They get funded. Steve in China pointing out, we can't just print money, true, but a private for-profit corporation called the Federal Reserve sure can. Bring the revolution on, I say. Best regards to everybody, Steve in China. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, we are a sovereign nation with a sovereign currency, and we can just print money. We really can. There's no sign of inflation out there for miles around. The deficit is falling. Is falling like tears in rain. Thank you, Rutger Hauer. But I come back to my essential thesis. If we want to educate children, if we want to feed hungry people, if we want to pave freaking roads, if we want to, well, you know how long the list is. We can't do that. We ain't got no money. Want to go bomb some brown people in the Middle East and help Jesus come back? Well, we got all the money in the world for that. Fire up the presses. Yeah, Randy and PA pointing out, if you tuned into the mainstream media, you would hear only that $700 billion was spent on defense. Unfortunately, that does not include things that are defense-related, like the Veterans Administration or the portion of the NASA budget that is dedicated to the military. Yeah, see? Yeah. Off we go to the phone. Hey, welcome to the program. Are you there, Angry?
Oh, sorry. I didn't know I was up.
Yeah, that's you.
How you doing, Bob? What's
doing good.
Attitudes. How do we, why aren't we discussing attitudes? And where I'm coming from with this is listening to you earlier when I got a chance to get onto the feed. Had a discussion with someone yesterday. Now, this person is conservative, but, it was really clear to me that when I first bumped into this individual, that there was a cloud I don't want to say negativity, but, unease. And what it came down to was she's hearing the historical, the paranoia, the nonsense from the GOP about ISIL or IS or ISIS or whatever the hell being in Mexico, and that they're coming in with Ebola across the border. Who's pumping this stuff? Was it Ted Cruz?
It's the usual suspects. The latest incarnation, Michael the Savage Wiener, has been screaming about typhus coming across the border, tuberculosis coming across the border, HIV. I mean, that's old shtick for him. And now he's screaming into his microphone. See, I told you. And now the ISIS people are bringing Ebola across the border from Mexico. I told you about these vermin.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they've got a lot of people freaked out. They've got a lot of people freaked out. And now with this mysterious respiratory illness that's affecting young people, primarily in the Midwest, there's a lot of people that are simply on they're on edge. And, of course, this was the point, to get folks so freaked out and so nervous that whatever Obama decided to ask for yesterday, they'll give him anything without question, without discussion. You know, just blank check. I mean, the only difference between him and Bush in this is that he's going to Congress to make it look legit.
Can I ask
But
you,
they've already been acting anyway.
Can I ask you a hypothetical out of all this?
Huh.
Do you think if Barack Obama, well, any American president, do you think if any American president went on television and said, my friends, I have determined that through a long and very serious deliberative process, it is necessary for us to drop a nuclear device on ISIL because they behead people. Do you think the American people would just go, yeah, okay, cool?
Yeah, actually, I do. And it's already at that point because folks are so freaked out about immigrants. They're so freaked out about Africa. Well, let's just say they're freaked out about Africans in Africa, and they're freaked out about Africans in the United States, too. You know, I mean, there's a lot of historical ideas that are floating around, but like you just said, these are things that have been bandied about for years. They've been bandied about for years. And when you have the New York Times, when you have Maureen Dowd, when you have supposedly credible news agencies that, you know, are making suggestions that, you know, black men that are being shot every 28 hours in the United States to death, that, you know, they come from bad neighborhoods, and it's not our fault. You know, we're the greatest country in the world, right? You know,
American
Cecilism said, you know, this is the greatest country in the world. So if we have to crack down on them with military gear, if we have to use tear gas, which is illegal under international law, then we just have to do that. It was the same attitude that was brought up during Occupy.
Well,
yeah,
it
was primarily
angry, isn't it also, since we have talked about violence against women a little bit this week, which we should probably be talking about constantly until it stops.
Yeah, but it's only because the NFL is involved. That's the only reason why anybody's talking
about
it.
Yeah, there's that, too. But I guess, you know, to the same extent that I was talking with Jim about the same attitude that says we won't fully fund our schools is the same attitude that says that we won't fully fund the VA. Well, by the same token, don't we have a problem in this country with a mindset that says, I wouldn't have to hit you if you wouldn't make me? I mean, isn't that what the United States says to the world? And isn't that what ever so many American men say to their spouses?
Well, yeah, but look at the society that you're living in. There are plenty of people that if I was to really sit and really discuss what we just talked about in the past couple of minutes, you know, the first thing they're going to say is, you know, because this happened to me already, well, you're just one of these, you know, angry black people, right? So, you know, you're one of these angry people of color. You just hate everything. You're against, you know, America. We've done everything for you. We've done you all of these favors. And this is the attitude that you have that you're even questioning that we need to go after our enemies. Because this is what I've been hearing all week. And then when you really push them, these people that will quote Dr. Martin Luther King all day long to you, especially if you're of color. And when you really push them into a corner where they cannot deny, say, Abu Ghraib, the fact that we have reporters to have to, this has always been where they've vetted their work through the intelligence services. But when you really put them into a corner with something like, for example, right now, because we're dealing with this, Michael Brown and Ferguson, then they will say some of the most bigoted things to you, whether they call you a nigger outright, you know, whether they call you a jungle bunny outright. You know, people have this idea that if we're not using specific language and if we're not lynching you, then, you know, there's really nothing for you to complain about.
Right.
But they will talk to you as if, go back to your place. You are out of your place. Not that you're out of line, that you're out of place. And see, and then they will say things, cause like I said, this happens to me. Well, you know, well, you black people this, or when it really gets down to it, when it really gets emotional, well, you niggas this and that. And the thing about it is they will turn around and say, well, you made me do that. By pointing out the racism that basically, you know, gives me unearned privilege, that gives my country unearned privilege, because let's face facts. You had, I believe his name was Scott Olson. He was drummed out of the Air Force when Bill Clinton was in office. And his father, who was a general in the Air Force, testified with him. I don't know if it was Senate, Congress, whichever side of the house they were talking to. And he says, look at my son. He's 6'4". He's blonde, blue-eyed. He's everything America represents. And, you know, nobody called him on that. Nobody but people of color called him on that.
Well, but by the same token, that's why, you know, I never get called an angry white man. I don't even get called an angry pink man. Because it's okay for me to be angry.
Well, yeah, until you start actually talking about, say, being Scots-Irish. Then they don't want to hear about it. When you start talking about Appalachia, that's when the line is drawn. You see?
Oh, yeah.
Because
because
then you put yourself into a position where they have to explain what, if you know the history, why these particular people are poor. Right? Because it's the same thing that you hear about black folks. Well, what is it about these people in Appalachia, in Florida, you know, these Florida crackers, right? Why is it that they can't get their thing together? Why is it that they can't stop drinking? Why is it they can't stop doing meth? Why is it that they can't stop stealing cars? Why is it that they can't do this and that? You know, I remember a fella I used to, you know, drink with when I used to drink, you know, a little bit, and he was like, hey, you know, I would not be allowed back home. I think he said he was from Alabama. He says, you know, I would not be allowed to, you know, sit in a lot of, you know, pub, you know, a lot of bars down there because I'm considered such white trash where I'm from. I'm not welcome in a lot of places. And I'm like, what are you saying? That's the same thing. And he goes, oh no, you can say, you know, they wouldn't take me out and like touch me up or anything, you know, but I'm just not welcome. And they let it be known. I'm not welcome in places. And he's like, I just want to point that out because I saw a couple of people that didn't treat you too nice when we were out this evening. So, you know, we all know that this goes on.
Yeah. And let me throw something out there for your consideration. You mentioned Scots-Irish. And this, you know, this is not cause and effect, but it's just more timeline stuff, Angry. And I was reminded of this when you mentioned Scots-Irish, and I thought about the fact that there's a rather hotly contested referendum coming up in Scotland, in which there's at least a 50-50 chance that they're going to break away from the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And it has gotten so frightening that all three leaders of the three major parties in England decided to travel north together across Hadrian's Wall to say, please, won't you stay in the Union?
Even George Galloway is talking like that.
And it was funny because the leader of the separatist movement said, well, this will probably work out rather well for us. The three most loathed men in the entire Union, and they came up here. They're making our argument for us. My bad Scots impression. I'm sorry. I can't resist. But anyway, the larger point there is that there are Scots-Irish and who will sell out others of their so-called own. And it goes back to the origins of Union. Once upon a time, the Scottish crown was paid off by the English crown to sell out his own country. I mean, we're going back to the time of the Bruces and stuff, if I recall correctly. And we've been doing that ever since. I mean, you mentioning Alabama reminds me of the fact that there is a move on in the area where I grew up to destroy that entire area for the sake of blasting and gouging out and boiling down tar sands. And, of course, that's the last low little knee hills of the Appalachians. And, you know, there'll be about half the people there who, yeah, hell, blow my house up because, you know, I'm going to get a nickel off my gas. And the other half of the Scots are going, yeah, I'll fight you. Some of this is some of this is endemic or some of this is human nature. I don't know, but it's goddamn frustrating.
Well, you do actually. I mean, when you look at the middle class, and especially when I hear people who are, you know, I can't believe you don't support the middle class. And I'm like, why should I support any class system? Why should I support any marginalization like that? Why would I do that? The whole point of the middle class is to perform a buffer, barrier, between those who have absolutely nothing to keep those people in line, right? Okay, let's look at South Africa, for example. I mean, you see the Oscar Pistorius trial is now over.
Yes.
And it looked like an American trial to me. He shot his unarmed girlfriend while she was in a bathroom, in a home. They have already had a history of, knockabouts. And, yes, South Africa is, pretty violent because there's these class disparities in between who has and who hasn't. But Pistorius is a white man, and he was a famous white man. He's known for his Olympics work. But the thing is, he's gun happy like everybody else. And had one in the home and shot into this thing and killed this girl. And he was found, these things happen. I mean, that's pretty much the way most women are reading that, regardless of their ethnicity in Africa, are reading that trial. But the thing about it is when we look at South Africa, after all of the changes, we've had Mandela, all of the changes, right? There was the rumor that white people were going to be wiped out in mass after Mandela died.
All the white people were going to get necklaced and yes.
Yeah, Pam Geller, a bunch of people here were pushing that meme, and of course nothing happened. But the thing is, we have the ANC, it's been black-led for the most part, and we had 30-some-odd miners at Marikina that were shot to death by the police, and it's just been pushed under the rug. Nothing has actually changed, but there is now a fairly sizable black middle class, an indigenous black middle class, and they if you argue with them, they will defend the system that was, because now that they have filled in that space, they now fill the space that the Boers used to fill, right? You had the British upper class, the white upper class, that were not Boer, that were not really Afrikaner, and then you had that ethnic Boer middle class. These were the plumbers, the police officers, the civil servants, the construction workers and what have you, and, they filled in that space. And when you look at the police force, the South African police force was more than 94 to 97% black, oppressing their own people. So why would it be a surprise that you would have a group of Scots-Irish or a group of unionists in Ireland who are going to work against their own people's best interests? We have Native American governments right now that work like that, that have always worked like that. We have black people within the African community that are put into leadership positions that have never represented our interests. We have Barack Obama, who we went out here and really mashed for, got this man elected, got him reelected, and the best thing he could do is to go to the NAACP and say, you're still lazy, you need to get up off your asses and take off your bedroom slippers and do something, even though the white working class is also still waiting for him to put on his comfortable shoes and show up to these marches. I haven't seen him represent anybody in the fast food workers movement. He didn't say anything about Occupy while he was in. He's not standing up for the people who are facing police brutality in Ferguson or anywhere else in the United States. So this is the type of leadership that we have. And then you have Hillary Clinton. Yeah, she's a female, and for that reason alone, you like to see her, move like people of color, like to see Obama up there. But what type of woman is she? Not only did she work for Walmart, and not only does she have a questionable history about demanding all kinds of intelligence and shit from diplomatic staff, we're talking about somebody who demands propaganda be on full all the time, that America's losing the information war because, people are starting to realize the truth about what the hell is going on. And this is why when Obama spoke yesterday, yeah, ISIL is a fucking problem. It is. But it's a problem that was caused by American actions. For the most part,
that leads angry to the larger inquiry. Okay, they're a problem. Whose problem are they? Is it our problem because of the Colin Powell Pottery Barn rule? You broke it, you buy it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question.
But you wander off into these swamps. And you just can't come out without a little pond scum on you. There's no, because there are no right answers. So there's that argument. We broke it. We have to fix it. But can you fix it with bombs? Then there's the secondary question, and President Obama tried to sort of nudge us in that direction last night. You know, there was a remark, I think Lottie made it in the chat room a few minutes ago, that President Obama says the same things as President Bush. He just uses $10 words and actual punctuation. Where war is concerned, that's kind of hard to challenge. But the problem is, and you know what, I'm see how I'm stammering and stuff. That means I'm processing and having problems. It's kind of my equivalent of buffering. But what it boils down to is, even that line about it's happening over there. Don't those countries have something to have some obligation to solve it for themselves? There's no long history of any countries over there being able to solve those kinds of problems.
Yeah, but Bob, when have they ever really tried to solve those things? And the U.S. has allowed them, and Britain has allowed them, and now Canada has allowed them to solve these things, or the French have allowed them to solve their own problems. Any way that they can solve their problems, any solving of the problem, leaves the West out, leaves the Anglophone world out, leaves Western capitalism out of that loop. And if we're really going to sit here and try to believe that there's some sort of moral superiority in the United States and the Anglophone world in general, to say that, oh no, all of this hassle since World War I has really been about us trying to help the Arabs. Well, they have all the resources, but then they're still living in the 15th century. They have all of these resources, and then when you look at someone like Saddam Hussein, was he a problem? Yes. Was he an annoyance? And I'm quoting Brent Scowcroft now. Yes, he was an annoyance. Was he a threat to anybody? Absolutely not. And when it came to dealing with terrorism, you know, Gaddafi, any of these strong-arm leaders that led halfway secular governments, when they caught these religious terrorists, they stomped them into the ground. Saddam Hussein, when he caught members of religious extremist groups, they tortured them to death. You know,
not to get information, but as a message.
But as a message, yeah, because they already know who's who for the most part. You see, you know, the whole point was to not let this get around, because people who are conservative have argued.
Before we make the mistake of having anyone think that we're saying that this is something that is unique to the Middle East, recall that the only way that Marshal Tito held that place called Yugoslavia together was by looking at the Croats and the Serbs and the Bosnians and the Herzegovinans and say, listen, I will kill every last one of you people if you don't behave.
Yeah, but see, that while that's true, one of the things that you really have to understand, and it takes time to understand a history, because I didn't really pay much attention to it until the Yugoslavian conflict during the mid-90s. And then, you know, because I had met somebody who was Bosnian, and he really got me to take a real objective look at that. There's been ethnic, it's easy to say ethnic strife, but let's just say, you know, before World War I, you know, the prejudice against Serbs. We talk a lot about Jews being wiped out, but we don't really talk about how Serbs have been treated. And Croatia has had a fascist, flavor to it for the longest. And when
what a long view nerd I am, Angry. All of that traces back to the missionary activities in post-schism Christianity, because the Croats, how does this work? The Croats get missionized by the Roman Catholic Church, and the Serbs get converted by the Greek Orthodox Church.
Well, Greek and Russian. Yeah. There was both of those influences, and Islam.
And then Islam's in the mix as well. And so, you know, it's ready made for conflict. No, I know what you're talking about when you say there's a deeper story there. But what I'm pointing to is that it is in the systemic nature of how the strongman operates. Whether that strongman is Marshal Tito or the strong man is Saddam Hussein, or for that matter, whether the strong man is Leonid Brezhnev. As soon as the Soviet Union fell, look at how quickly everybody broke away from everybody else. And the larger point, Angry, is that to a certain extent, we can even see that operationally inside the United States.
Well, yeah, but see, outside of Native Americans and a few other small groups, who the hell actually really has the claim? And that's the other thing that got me about his chit-chat to the public last night, was because he is defending, you know, and I'm not saying that it shouldn't have happened, because nobody gave a damn about Yazdi people up until about a month ago. But, you know, the aerial attacks they were using to supposedly protect these people, and then talking about, you know, their sovereignty needs to be respected. Well, what about Palestine? And if we're really going to go further, what about my own people right here in North America? And I'm talking about North America from Mexico all the way up to, you know.
Yeah. None of that is lost on me. And that's, you know, the overall answer to me. I mean, what if there really are, and it's time, I suppose, for our obligatory Star Trek reference. What if there really was value to the Kobayashi Maru exercise at Starfleet Academy? What if you actually learn something about someone in a situation that has no winnable solution? What if you find something about problem solving? What if you find out something about character? What if you find out something about the basic intelligence of recognizing that it is unwinnable?
Yeah, but, I mean, come on. What did George Tenet say after he left the agency? You know, there was no way that doing it the way that they're talking about doing it, that this was going to work out well. This is going to cause more of a problem. Everybody who has any sort of respect within the intelligence field, or someone who is an analyst as far as dealing from a news perspective, looking back at this, I mean, Seymour Hersh, name whoever you choose. The more that they come down with the hammer on these people, the more resistance they're going to inspire. You cannot continue to keep kicking people who don't have anything to lose and think that they're not going to fucking fight back and bite back. That's crazy. This is why I'm saying we look at the Middle East or whatever you want to call it, Western Asia, depending on what you want to call it, these petroleum resources. And now they're looking at the mineral resources in Afghanistan. They say that that's completely outweighing the petroleum in Afghanistan.
That story broke 2 or 3 years ago, that Afghanistan is sitting on top of some of the most vast reserves of rare earth elements that the planet has to offer. And I remember I remember when the story came out, and I said, we ain't going nowhere.
Nowhere. Right. It's the same thing with the golden triangle that was created. Now, yes, it doesn't mean that, you know, the people who run all of this stuff really sit around and say, well, we hate these people, so we're going to go ahead and we're going to do this. But they're like, well, hey, we're making profit out of this. So we have, you know, criminalized groups within intelligence, within law enforcement, within government, within the military. They can't do these things separately. They have to have help from inside somewhere who have their own agendas. And they do what the hell that they want to do. They do what they want to do. But what we're really getting down to, though, Bob, is the majority of people in this country, in any society, cannot give themselves a negative. Can they condemn themselves? Can you really say? I mean, Ray Rice. Do you think Ray Rice is really saying to himself, oh, yeah, I really fucking went over the goddamn top. Maybe she did have a fucking, maybe she was really fucking pushing me and I don't like what the fuck she said, but I'm 200 some odd goddamn times professional fucking football player and I knocked this chick out on fucking camera, dragged her out of the fucking lift, dropped her because I saw him walk around when he realized the situation he was in, that there were all these goddamn witnesses. But what is happening?
No, granted, we're engaging in some pretty full on speculation at this point, but the issue with regard to Ray and Jhené Rice, I'm very skeptical, not because I think it isn't warranted, and not because I think it isn't maybe sometimes beneficial. Sometimes it works even. But I'm kind of skeptical, and it's based on real-time experience. I'm skeptical of programs that say, okay, if you manage to not get arrested for beating up your wife anymore for a whole year and you go to these classes, the charges will be dropped and there will be no there will be no criminal history whatsoever, and you can claim that, you know, you're as pure as the driven snow. Because that, mentally and psychologically, what that tells the perpetrator is that there is a series of hoops which he must jump through, at which point he is going to be absolved for the thing which he did.
Of course, but this is what I'm saying. If you look at the Civil Rights Bill, if you look at these various civil rights laws, you look at the fact that Barack Obama is a black man, he's been elected president, how many times has that been thrown up? Well, we've done for you. We've done penance already. So we don't want to hear any more complaints, even though the abuse continues to go on. So by saying to Ray Rice, okay, well, we're going to suspend you for a couple of games. Oh, okay, well, what you did, more people found out about it. More people are angry about it. Okay, well, we're going to go to the next step. Oh, more people found out about it. More people this. Okay, we're going to go to the next step. In the meantime, we have this other NFL or sports person for basketball or whatever it is, because I'm not into sports, who gets caught in the email saying, I think it's really fucked up. Well, we got a lot of racists and shit in the South, and they don't come to the games because there's just too many niggas in the goddamn stadium. So we got to figure out a way to get these people to get, you know, over this, or find out a way to get rid of all these goddamn blacks and just leave them on the court where they belong so that we can get this money. And how we'll pay penance is, well, hey, we got a lot of black people playing in the NFL, so what do you mean we're racist? What are you talking about? We're doing you a favor.
Oh, God. Yeah, I know.
Every time, you know, some aid package goes someplace, try telling somebody who really believes in American exceptionalism that, oh, we're not doing good. We're not helping with Ebola. We're not helping this. We're not helping that. I'm like, well, how about helping the Palestinians? Well, they deserve to lose their land because it wasn't really theirs anyway. Oh, okay. So you mean these people can come back after 70 AD, after they were kicked out by the Romans, and reclaim land that they haven't held since then? Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah, that's legitimate. Okay. Well, I'm Native American, goddammit. I want my land back. Oh, well, that's unreasonable.
Yeah.
See?
Reparations,
but
damn
we'll
it.
Go in and, you know,
reparations.
No, you know, but we'll go in, and I'll give a damn about the Yazidis, even though I didn't know anything about them last year. And I'll say, give them all of my goddamn tax money to do this. To, you know, all of this is to keep everything going. Because if we were to be fair about everything, everything would look different. I mean, it's not just Scotland that's talking about breaking off. You have Alsace-Lorraine that's talking like this. You have Catalan that's talking like this. The Isle of Skye is talking like
right.
this.
Right, and that's why I've been pointing out over the last year or so that what we are seeing is a retreat from the idea of the nation state as it was espoused at the Treaty of Westphalia and the Treaty of Osterbrook, because that's where the modern nation state is born.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was born out of hundreds of years of European warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, maybe it looks like we're going in the direction of not being so interested in that anymore. That we want to, where possible, split away into little ethnic enclaves.
Yeah,
where we go from there is lather, rinse, repeat.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And see, and that's where I'm concerned, because I'm all for sovereignty. I want my people to be sovereign. But that does not mean you cannot have alliances. That does not mean you cannot work together. But the point is, emotionally, the majority, especially Scots, the Welsh, they've been kicked around for years. They're tired of having their sons kicked around. They're tired of not being able to speak their language. Still, they're tired of being mocked by
the
English.
That's the other part. You know, that's the other part of my family tree. The vast majority of what I am is Scots and Welsh.
Well, they're both Celtic, though. Right?
Yeah, right. Well, but...
No sense in going into the
migratory patterns and everything, but it leaves us in a mess.
Yeah, a very bad mess.
And see, I th- I read an article. Our buddy Mr. Gibson sent it along a couple of nights ago. He's in the chat room. Hi, Mr. Gibson. And it was about Washington, Oregon, and California making a decided and concerted effort to get away from coal-fired electricity. And moving full steam ahead, probably the wrong term, toward sustainables and renewables, solar, wind, geothermal, hydroelectric. And I agree with all of this. But inside, and this is more of a linguistic observation, Angry, inside the body of the article was the phrase, as California and Washington and Oregon retreat from coal. And I read that and went, what the, who wrote this? How is it? I mean, I understand a little teeny tiny bit of military tactics. Anytime you're moving forward, you're not retreating.
Yeah.
But it's described.
But I bring
that up because I got an article yesterday from our buddy Cindy in the Great Northwest about how, you know, remember the Oath Keepers, Angry?
I see them all. Yeah.
They're going operational. they're forming a full-on armed militia.
And that's legal, right?
Right. But understand, since we're talking about language, you know, retreat from coal, since we're talking about language, they're forming an armed militia group, but it's only a militia because they're white. If they were any other color under the sun, they would be an armed gang.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, news reports of these assholes along the border in Arizona who attacked a bunch of scientists, well, they were described in the news reports as a militia. You know, if you're attacking a bunch of scientists because you think that they're illegal aliens, you're not a militia. You're a goddamn gang. And the only reason they call themselves militias is because of the use of that pernicious word in the Second Amendment.
Well, look, it's just like when Obama spoke yesterday. I tried to point out to people. He made it very clear. He goes, anybody who threatens American interests. He didn't say the homeland, right? He said interests. And what is ISIL, ISIS, IS, whatever the hell? They're taking over all of the oil fields. But if you're not paying attention to what is being said and put it within context, it doesn't make any sense. So when you talk about what you're talking about right now, it's the same thing. Without looking at the context, folks will take this information flat out and not look any further and be afraid to look any further, because if they look any further, they're going to get contradictory information, which then gives them a brain pain. And then you have to sit and ask yourself, like, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre, ask his fellow Frenchman, can a man condemn himself? Can France say to itself that what's going on in Indochina is what France started? What is happening in Algeria is what France caused? Because a small amount of people wanted greed, and they wanted territory. And because the Frenchman thought that if he fought for Algeria, that somehow it would make him king over that part of Africa, even though he comes out of a, you know, small town in France, that means nothing. This is what gives him his meaning in life. And when you listen to people like Ted Cruz, you listen to conservatives, you listen to the average person who just can't get it out of their head that they live in the greatest thing going, that any change from this program, anything that does not maximize and, you know, retain American power as they can see it, they're not going to go for anything else. They, you know, they will rationalize all of this away. And when we see the violence coming home, we see Ferguson, we see what happens, we saw what happened during Occupy. You know, if that didn't get the white community to get up off his ass, I don't know what will. Don't tell me about Arab Spring. Don't tell me about a possible African Spring when you can't even get young people here to try to get out from under debt. You know, the same sort of debt that led to the subprime housing crisis, which led to crashing the, you know, Anglophone global economy. If we're not going to start, you know, really being honest with ourselves about how in this supposed democracy, we, if all of this is really true, that we supposedly have say, we allowed it to get this far. You know, and allowing, you know, the Obama administration, the Bush administration, I mean, the fact that Dick Cheney can still come around after all the damage that he's done and still be heard and still get, you know, press the people are still asking his advice. This man has been caught lying how many different times? He's the one of the main reasons we're in, if not the main reason we're in this position. And we're talking about this on 911.
Yeah, I know. I had a quote here. Let me see if I can find it real quick. I had a quote here from our buddy Shorty in L.A., and it's absolutely fascinating because it's, among other things, it's a quote from Dick Cheney. ISIS does not – wait a minute. Let me get my Dick Cheney voice on. ISIS does not recognize a border between Syria and Iraq, so neither should we. We should immediately hit them in their sanctuary, staging areas, command centers, and lines of communication, mm-hmm. wherever mm-hmm. we find them. We should provide significantly increased numbers of military trainers, special operations forces, and intelligence architecture and air power to aid the Iraqi military and the Kurdish Peshmerga in their counteroffensive against ISIS. We work to defeat ISIS and prevent the establishment of a terrorist safe haven in the heart of the Middle East. We must move globally to get back on offense on the war on terror.
Holy
shit.
Yeah, it's PNAC all over again.
It's PNAC all over again. Why is this man not mumbling this stuff from inside a cell in The Hague?
Yeah, but evidently, and I don't think I'm wrong about this, but my initial analysis of this is that he's going around to basically give legitimacy to the Islamic State. So that way there's a justification to go and do all of this damage, because I don't take them seriously. I mean, people are starting to mock them in the Arab world. People are laughing at them. And the fact that whatever's supposed to be Al-Qaeda, they say that they don't want anything to do with them because they're barbaric. You understand?
Oh, yeah.
Nobody really supports this. You know, I mean, people have to, especially, you know, I guess maybe for me because I grew up in a bad neighborhood, you know, the idea of intimidation on how, you know, people take and steal and feed off of each other. You know, when you look at, you know, folks, I mean, a lot of this was taught to me initially by people who survived the Holocaust. They're like, look, you know, I'm not knocking, you know, those of us who got out, but those of us who were able to steal, that were able to fight better, we survived. And, you know, and they were all like, you know, you have to understand that, you know, anytime you have, you know, people who are left with nothing, you have, you know, a cycle of self-inflicted abuse, and it develops a certain mindset. So, you know, when we look at what's happening in Africa in terms of the piracy, which you don't really hear about too much anymore, when we look at these, religious extremists and so on, you know, these are not mainstream, educated, college-educated people for the most part. These are some of the poorest, and they have absolutely nothing. And like I said, you know, they have all of these resources in their country and it's going elsewhere. And while everything is being cycled on the Islamic State, was more than likely came out of the Syrian resistance because they're using American equipment, for what I understand. You know, look at Saudi Arabia. They locked off 300 some odd people they killed this last year. And how many beheadings?
Oh, Lord. How many? And that, which reminds me of something, Angry, and it's worth pointing out. I can remember being a little baby Baptist growing up in the Baptist church. See how that works? But I remember being sermons being preached from the pulpit because, you know, Southern Baptists are, you know, tough on crime, about how in Saudi Arabia they cut a man's hand off for stealing. Now, you can go to Saudi Arabia, and you'll see a lot of people with only one hand, but you very seldom see one with none. You know, this from an outfit that preaches, you know, the forgiveness by grace, salvation by grace.
Yeah.
But we, no, see, that's the thing. We get off on that stuff, Angry. We get off on it. Mm-hmm. There's an element in our country that wishes we could do that. It was on display when that shit would be preached from the pulpit.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, when I was a schoolboy, and I'll let you go after this, but, you know, this is something you could really, you know, look, you know, get people to talk about. If they're not going to look at this society, then look at classical Rome. You know, if we're really going to talk about, you know, what was Rome, well, let's ask ourselves what Rome was. You know, we're looking at, you know, in hindsight, at the incredible violence and sadism. And the, you know, the overreach of really early capitalism in terms of how the Roman working class was exploited in taxes, and how government officials and the Senate and the military, you know, jockeyed for power. I mean, none of this was done for Rome. This was done for their own little petty ambitions. And then, you know, the various assassinations, you know, whether it's Julius Caesar or the Gracco family, you know, any of that. And then we look at how Rome fell to the point where they were hiring mercenaries that were doing their fighting because they had extended their empire so far and gave absolutely nothing to those that they were exploiting.
Right.
And it eventually imploded upon them.
But again, the military of empire is different from the military of the republic. Mm. And it goes back to those observations I was making about shared sacrifice.
Yeah, well, the same thing happened in the Maya empires. I mean, it was an empire. North America, outside of Mexico, didn't really deal with that, the idea of kingship and royal families. But the Inca and Maya, you know, empires, they were just as violent, just as exploitative. They used ethnic rivalries to keep people in line. There was a lot of psychology and divide and conquer that was used. And that's what allowed the Spanish to come over with such limited numbers, you know, superior war technology, though, but, you know, limited numbers to be able to do what they did. So when we listen to the GOP and then we're witnessing the fracturing of what was the mainstream order after World War II, you know, under one superpower, and we see all of these groups that are really actively voting when they're given a chance to break off from these other countries. I mean, I'm all for independence, but we need to understand why, you know, this sort of thing is happening and recognize that this is what fascism looks like, whether we want to admit it or not. And we keep getting into, you know, lost in this train of thought that everything has to look like the German Nazi Party or it's not fascism.
Yeah.
India has moved to the right. The United States, whether it's Obama or the Clintons, has moved to the right. You know, Canada is hopelessly right. Mexico has always been to the right. Australia, New Zealand. I mean, what Tony Abbott is doing in Australia is despicable. When you really take into account Australian politics over the decades.
Yeah, and at the risk of, well, not really a risk. I'm sure if Robert's listening, he'll know what I'm getting at. They wound up with Tony Abbott, even though they've got mandatory voting in Australia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That
says what?
Well, that says that. That sometimes, even if everybody votes, the people go stupid, mm-hmm. or a majority of them do. And I only say that because I saw a reference in something I read today, and I can't call it immediately to mind, Angry. But I saw something today saying, by God, if we had mandatory voting in the United States like Australia does, we wouldn't wind up with these shit brains in Congress.
Well, I'll tell you what. No. Yeah. I mean, that's a mistake. And even though it's not directly related, but it is a factor that, you know, most people would not mention. And I'll leave you with this. I believe it was Trufaut, if not Alternet. It turns out, and I can't remember who did the study, but, you know, 3/4 of the white people in the United States do not have any minority friends at all, let alone African.
Yeah. Or something like one.
Yeah.
Yeah. The average black person has 3 white friends. The average white person has 1 black friend. I haven't figured out the math on that yet.
You know, so who's really talking to who and who's getting along?
There's that, but I mean, I also have to, you know, there's trouble with the definition of friend. But
friend, yeah.
But you know, to the extent that we were talking about our predilection for sort of forming little ethnic enclaves. Well, what the hell do you think segregated housing is? What is segregated schooling? It's exactly.
But that didn't happen, Bob.
Yeah,
you know, we lived like that because we wanted to, because we didn't want to have anything to do with white people. So we wanted to live on top of one another. 3 families in a 2-bedroom.
Sure.
We want that.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
We want to be homeless, right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
we enjoy these things. These vets that are coming back with their mental problems, they're just weak. You know, it's not their, you know, it's not their fault. You know, I mean, it's not anybody else's problem.
Yeah.
You know, it's their problem.
Right. And it's just like, well, you know, it's all a form of Calvinism. Your life would be better if God liked you. And if you're wealthy, it's because God does.
well,
but no, we have a taste for this kind of stuff. But there are larger questions. For instance, I sit here behind a microphone for 3 hours, and I'm proud. I am honest to Jesus proud of the makeup, as I understand it, of the Horn Family Commune congregation, because it takes in it crosses a whole bunch of boundaries. It crosses gender boundaries. It crosses orientation boundaries. It crosses ethnic and so-called racial boundaries, and we've really got a nice little mix here. And yet, if you ask me, and I had to think about this when I saw that survey, Angry, if you had to ask me, or if you, does Bob Kincaid have any black friends? Well, I live in a really, really white state.
Mm-hmm.
So the best that I can say is that there are some black folks in town that I'm perfectly genial with and friendly to. Are we friends? How do you define that? I just live in a place where there aren't a lot of black folks. Now, when I've lived in places where there are people of color, I've had people of color who are friends, and I hope that maybe I can cheat and consider the people in this little online community that we've built to be friends. But it's not an easy definition. I've worked in workplaces where, you know, there'd be 42 white people and 3 people of color. And we worked perfectly well together, and, you know, no biases or isms involved. Just at end of the workday comes, they go home, I go home.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing. You're working together. You're not really talking and, like, having the kinds of discussions that we have over the dinner table, you know.
Oh, no, no. We'd go out drinking after work absolutely.
No, but what I'm trying to say is, unless we're really, you know, really, see, friend with us is, you're a white guy, and I can tell you that, you know, such and such really hurts my feelings. And you listen, and you actually have something to say. See, when we hang out with most white people, we hold back. Because if we were to really discuss what the hell goes on with us, if we were to really say what we think, the majority of white people wouldn't hang around us. And I'm telling you this out of personal experience, because I don't really hold back. All right? I say exactly what the hell I think. And when people say, well, you know, this, that, and the other about this place, and I'm like, well, you know, really, they left a boy's body who was shot unarmed, shot at 11 times, hit however many times in the street for 4 hours, and then he ran over the little memorial that his mother put down for the body. Now, if there was a little white girl who went missing and she was found like that and the police acted the exact same goddamn way, Michael Wiener, the Savage Wiener, Rush Limbaugh, you know, all of these freaks would be up and down. Sean Hannity would twist his lip and scream all day long about how there was no respect for this, you know, Christian family. They would make some whatever the hell out of it.
Persecution. Persecution. They're being persecuted.
You know, the thing about it is, in order for us to be able to walk around and deal with white people, we got to pretend that there's absolutely no animus. That we, you know, and the thing about it is, there, you know, with a lot of folks, I'm not going to sit here and lie and say that we're not angry. We are angry. But the thing is, we deal with it a hell of a lot differently. We get angry with ourselves, and we drink, and we do drugs, and we have, you know, sex unsafely, and we damage ourselves because of the stress of not being able to express what the hell we think and what we feel. Because to do so means you might lose your job. You will definitely lose your social circle. You know, you cannot be welcome at your church anymore. You have this mixed church. Oh, we love everybody. Well, see, I want to talk about the fact that black men are being shot every 28 hours in the United States. Well, see, now you're being hateful because we're not bigoted, so you need to just forget it because we're not bigoted. You know, I'm not treating you badly, so you basically need to let the rest of the white world off the hook because I'm not treating you badly. But see, when a black man does something, though, I'm supposed to apologize. If a Native American has an alcohol problem, I'm supposed to apologize.
All of which is of a piece, for instance, with the crap that we hear out about. You hear it. This being the anniversary of September 11, 2001, I remember hearing, well, you know, okay, so maybe there are some Muslims who don't hate America and want to destroy us and establish Sharia law and the global Islamic caliphate. Well, you know what? They need to do something about the people who do. Everybody gets held responsible for the bad acts of their particular demographic, except white folks. I mean, I don't know how many other people out there do this, but I know I'm a rarity in that I say, you know what? Those Christians need to do something about the Westboro Baptists and the Southern Baptists. Those Christians, I mean, they need to declare that they're not really, that those people really aren't Christians. But you know what? Apparently sauce for the goose is not sauce for the gander.
No, you know, whenever I say to somebody, but the Klan is a Christian organization, no, they're not. I've had people get very angry with me.
It's gotten hotter. I remember how hot it once got around here when I noted that, there's that guy again. Adolf Hitler died a baptized Roman Catholic and has never been excommunicated to this day. And in fact, the man who became John the 23rd got himself in deep shit and almost didn't make it to Pope because he suggested when he was an academic, he suggested that Hitler should be excommunicated.
Well, look, I just
sent
you a link.
And the papacy had a hissy.
Yeah, I just sent you a link not too long ago. An American school student turned in a paper when asked a question to compare George W. Bush between Adolf Hitler, and this particular student said, from my analysis, I see them as being damn near exactly the same. And now this student is in trouble.
Yeah.
For being objective.
Right. How much free speech? See, I mean, I'm looking at a story right now to the Christian Science Monitor. I'm looking at a photograph of a woman holding up a big placard that says, Restore the First Amendment. And this, of course, is from a gathering outside the Senate, because not too very long ago at all, like within the last couple of hours, the Republicans in the Senate outright killed the constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. Kirsten Gillibrand was absent from the vote, but it was 54 Democrats and Independents, and every single Republican voted against it.
And you ask Democrats, it's like, well, how did this happen if you're trying to make sure that everybody votes, if you're really protecting my constitutional rights? Same thing with the Republicans. If you're defending the Tea Party. Somebody accused me of being a Tea Party because I said I don't politically support Obama. I don't. But again, this is somebody who doesn't understand the process, you know, who really got tribal, which goes back to all these states wanting to break off. This sort of tribalism is a sign of the far right. It's a sign of fascism. The fact that, you know, folks will not even look at anything objectively simply because they don't want to hear it. You can't get any worse than this. And American exceptionalism is no different. It's no different. You know, and if we're going to really talk about fixing things, I mean, none of this should be fixed until we can start being honest with ourselves about how we got to this point. You know, and it's not going to happen in the current political climate. It just won't. You know, something bad is going to happen, evidently. It's really going to have to shock everyone to really realize that we're being taken for a ride. But, you know, as you're saying, though, plenty of people know that they're being taken for a ride. But if it's psychologically comfortable, they're going to go right along with it. They're going to go right along with it. And, you know, that's one of the biggest problems, I think, that we have. And until, you know.
You said tribal herd mentality.
Yeah, well, a tribal mentality is a herd mentality. That's exactly what it is. You know, people have this idea of tribe and ooga booga, you know, because this is what has been presented in the movies. See, in North America, many of us who are really politically, you know, conscious, I would say, we don't accept tribe because we signed agreements with the United States government. By law, by federal law, they can only sign agreements with other like-minded, I mean, not like-minded, but like-statured governmental agencies, meaning that every time they sign an agreement with the Dene, with the Lakota, with any nation you care to name, they basically admitted that these are sovereign nations. You know, that whole tribalism thing. I mean, any group could break off at any time, and most of them did. That's why they were spread out. You know, you could disagree. Groups break off all the time. But the fact, when you have had unity for a period of time, you have to ask yourself, how did you get the unity? How much violence was used to do this? If you're, like you mentioned, Yugoslavia, using force to bring people together. No, you know, it doesn't work in the long run. Because what you end up doing is encouraging xenophobia, which then encourages far-right political leanings, which then encourages what we understand as fascism. And that's the way the United States is moving, whether anybody wants to admit it or not. And this is what the Koch brothers and, you know, those of that ilk have been trying to do for the longest. And shamefully, the Democratic Party, who is, you know, just into money as the Republican Party is, will do what they need to do to first survive and second to try to profit from this, to try to maximize their own positions out of this conundrum. Because they're not trying to change the system in any way, shape, or form. There is no reform, and there is no objective accounting for. So this is why Cheney, after everything that he did, we all know that he lied to the public, lied to Congress, he's still allowed to influence the political current.
Well, he's still allowed larger than that, he's still allowed to walk around a free man.
Somebody wants him out there.
Yeah.
Somebody wants him out there.
It's not hard to figure out who. Hey, by the way, I got to interrupt this train of thought for just a minute, A, because we're kind of running out of time, Angry. But secondly, got a note in here from Greg saying, please announce where people can go to hear Angry and hear his program. He says, I've always liked hearing him and I want to follow him. So would you put the details out there, please?
Oh, yeah, well, for the most part, I mean, it's just angryindianradio.wordpress.com.
And is it R-A-D-I-O or?
Yeah. Yes, it's the regular radio, because when I did it the other way, no one got it. It was spelled the Pinoy way. Nobody really got that. So it's angryindianradio.wordpress.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, @TheAngryIndian, one word.
Cool. Cool. What about the program itself?
Oh, they'll find the program there with Angry Indian Radio.
The
RSS feed, everything is there.
Okay, mm-hmm. Cool. Well, we always have a good conversation, Angry, and I do appreciate it. I sincerely do. I don't know if we solve any problems, but at least we put out enough information for people to try to reach some kind of an informed conclusion or an informed opinion. If not a conclusion, I don't know if conclusions are even possible. So thank you very kindly.
No, I mean, thank you, man. You know, I mean, there needs to be some openness for actual discussion instead of people just flinging their opinions. And then when you ask them, well, what is your opinion based on? Well, it's my opinion, but what is it based on? Well, it's my opinion. Well, my opinion is based on fact. What is yours based on? Well, it's based on my opinion. I don't have to, you know, explain anything to you. See, that's what we have to combat.
Yeah. And that's what is out there in shocking profusion.
Yeah, it's all over the place, and it's a shame that, you know, stupidity can't be painful, because then folks will maybe seek some help. You know, but anyway, man, you be cool. Peace to you and yours. Tell Agnes I hope she's cool, and everybody, if you can support this show, please do.
Oh,
peace.
Thank you for the reminder. Thank you, Andy, Angry, the Angry Indian. Thank you, Angry, very, very kindly. It is much appreciated. As far as supporting the program is concerned, I want to thank Philip for jumping in this evening. So we had 150 to raise. We are at 120 to go. And for anyone interested, Sparky's Ghost Pepper and or Jalapeno Pistachio challenge is still on the table. Anybody want to kick in $100, Sparky will personally mail you your choice of a package of smoky ghost pepper cheese or a package of jalapeno pistachios that are grown not too terribly far from where Sparky himself resides. You can go to PayPal and make sure you send me your mailing address in the memo section there if you decide you want to go out on a limb and try this hellaciously hot, smoky ghost pepper cheese. And by the way, just hey, let's go back to the phones for a minute. Hey, welcome to the program.
Refresh my memory. You hit it last night with Charles Martel and King of Poland, Sobieski. What was his first name?
Jan.
Okay. Yeah. Because he had to rescue Vienna from the Muslims, as they called them in those days. I mean, it's funny, Bob. It seems that I don't care what religious group it is, they'll find a way to fight somebody else. Huh? The Hundred Years' War. You're familiar with that in Germany?
Yeah. Sure.
Wasn't that Lutherans versus Catholics?
Just about everybody, I think. I mean, yeah, but
pardon me?
Yeah, Lutherans versus Catholics, and the various denominations, and well, I don't think it's fair to say Lutherans versus Protestants versus.
Well, Luther was the first guy to really break away from the Catholic Church, correct? From the Master Church.
Yes, the Mother.
He made the first impact. And in France, what were Huguenots? Were they a Protestant sect also?
Yes.
And Calvin came out of where?
Calvin comes out of Switzerland, I believe. But he gets real traction in, of all places, Scotland. Now, the Hundred Years' War was the war between arguably England and France, although it's more a war between houses, between the Royal House of Valois and the Royal House of Plantagenet.
Oh, that was Richard the Lionheart. Wasn't that his family tree?
Yeah, Plantagenet.
God. Well, you hit it tonight, too. Here's another piece of kind of sarcastic humor. Are you familiar with the Spencer books? Yeah, TV show.
Oh, yeah. I don't know that I've ever read the books, but I'm familiar, yes.
You never have? Well, it's decent stuff. It's, but the villain that Spencer went into and went up against in the first books was a guy named Joe, and the last name was B-R-O-Z. Didn't we forget a name on the end of that?
D-I-T-O?
Yeah, exactly. Some of these writers, man, I got to give them credit. You guys are on tonight, there's no doubt about it. I have a little difference of opinion on the Korean action. My problem is they should have stopped at the 38th parallel. And the only thing I'll say is today, take a look at the economy and the situation in South Korea. I think they're eating a lot better than the folks in North Korea. And the North Korean family is the same one that was there in 1950. That sound like socialist or communist to you?
No, it sounds like dirty old autocratic dictatorship.
Yeah, I just wonder, you think that if it gets real rough, you think the Chinese will do something there because it's affecting their economy, for instance?
No, I don't, because the reality is that the North Koreans have nuclear weapons, and far more so than South Korea or China, I mean, or Japan, the Chinese have the most to worry about regarding that, because, and so it's a lot easier just to let the North Korean people starve.
Yeah. Which they are doing. From what I can understand, from everything I hear.
And the North Koreans are handy to
have a villain.
Well, no, they're handy to the Chinese because they provide a constant source. They're an irritant to us and to the so-called West.
Well, I think I've read a few things and heard a few things about a lot of North Koreans crossing the Yalu and getting into China, trying to become residents of China. because it's one thing about China, there's a job there. It might not be a good one, but I look at our own country, Bob, and I see the same thing. The job situation is bull. It's bad. But you and the Indian, I tell you, I appreciate that, you guys, when you get together, because
the truth is
walking all over us, you know?
Yeah, we have some wonderful conversations, and you're echoing something that Kate said a few minutes ago. She wrote in and said, Bob and the Angry, thank you for the good segment. Right on, brother. You say everything I know and believe. Refreshing to hear.
Well, he says things that I think about, and I wonder sometimes when I think about them, well, are you finally losing an old timer? You're getting so paranoid this crap that you're seeing, is crap. And of course, if you open your mouth about it, the only thing I'll say about that Korean mess, that was, you know, the League of Nations has been criticized over and over and over for letting things happen and nobody said a word, you know, during that time. But you notice the UN is now, they send out peacekeepers, didn't they? A bunch of UN peacekeepers just get released in Syria?
I think so, yeah. But by the way, and we're running out of time. But in the enemy of my enemy is my friend department, it wasn't too long after President Obama's speech last night that it was the family of one of the beheaded journalists said, oh, by the way, those moderate Syrian opposition folks, they were the people who sold our family member to ISIL in the first place.
Yeah, it's chaos. You and I go back to the end of World War One and say, here, the British and French went in there, and they took something that was already screwed up and made it worse. And now it's even worse. So,
well, we can indeed. We've never been very good at foreign policy. And, well, Bill, we can screw up a one-car funeral as necessary. Hey, I got to roll out of here. Hopefully we'll talk a little longer next time.
A free meal. You take care, Bob.
All right, see you, Bill. Bye now. Mr. Stress, our buddy Bill, calling from Cleveland. It is. It's really time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody, for helping keep all of this going. Big thanks going out to Sal in the final minutes of the program, who took Sparky up on his challenge. That means we have only $20 to go to finish fundraising for the evening. Thank you very kindly. That makes a big difference. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox, and congratulations on a successful album kickoff in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACACT.org. And always, 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 Gina. It's all for you.